Welcome to the Legal Navigator podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca from Law Training Center. In today's episode, we are delighted to have a special guest with us, Emma Taylor. With over 15 years of experience in the legal sector, Emma specializes in cases involving child welfare and safeguarding issues. She's an expert in handling contact and residence disputes, relocation cases, and is well-versed in dealing with complex medical evidence cases related to non-accidental injuries and abuse cases. Emma's also a family law mediator. She is a resolution accredited specialist in private law for children and the Trust of Land and Appointment of Trustees Act cases. Currently, she serves as a partner and the head of the family department at Good Law Solicitors. And in this episode, we will delve into Emma's journey and find out more about her role in the legal profession. And she will also be sharing valuable advice for those aspiring to embark on a similar legal pathway. So stay tuned to learn more. But before we dive into our discussion, thank you very much, Emma, for joining us today. It would be really good if you could just share with our listeners today just a bit about your background. It would be good to also know what exactly motivated you to pursue a career in the legal profession as well.
So I am now a partner in a relatively large sort of high street practice in Brighton and Hove, and we've got an office in Surrey as well. But it's taken a while to get here. I remember when I was little, you know, you get the whole what do you want to be when you grow up kind of questions. And I always wanted to be a vet or work in musical theatre. Never wanted to be a lawyer. Nobody in my family really had been to university. And sort of my mum worked in shops and GP practices. And my dad worked in a bank. And I think the first time I came across law was in work experience week, perhaps year 10 or 11, whenever you do it. And at that time, my lifelong best friend was saying, oh, I'm going to my dad's solicitor's practice to do a week's work experience. Do you want to come? And I think we thought it would just be a jolly, you know, we'll just have a week off together enjoying ourselves. And we went. And ever since then, really, I got the bug, even though we were archiving and photocopying and that sort of is where the interest came from. After that, I elected A-levels and did straight law. I still wanted to be in musical theatre though, so I did drama and theatre studies as well, along with I think English language and Spanish. But I kept feeling that law kept drawing me back. Every topic we did was really interesting. I liked the way you sort of applied all these theories to the facts of cases. So I went to university ultimately and studied straight law at the University of Kent. I wanted to be a barrister at that point, or I thought I did. And I thought that's the best way to combine the love of drama with the law. You get to walk into court and wear a wig and perform. And so that was sort of the motivation. I loved how, you know, all these different bits of information would come together to help make a decision. It seemed logical to me. It was a logical sort of way of approaching things, and the job just seemed interesting, I suppose. I wanted to practice in mental health law at university, and that was one of the it was my dissertation subject, and definitely I was drawn more to the people focused laws rather than the commercial sort of transactional type things. So yeah, and then that was sort of the route to coming out of university anyway, and finding the law, really.
Oh, that is very interesting. I feel like I have such a similar sort of background as well, because I started off wanting to do performing arts, and I also did mental health law and child welfare actually for my dissertation as well in university. Yeah. So that's quite really interesting. So I guess what I would like to ask is that there's often like a common misconception amongst newcomers that start their journey in the legal profession. Often people think that it will align with the stereotypical things that you see on TVs or in movie shows, like you mentioned, like silks or suits, for example, only to find out that reality paints quite a different picture. So I'm curious to know, upon doing your like initial work experience and now that you're a more seasoned professional, how did you picture your role in like the legal profession when you first started? And how has that transformed as you've gained your experience? So is it what you've expected?
In my generation, we were more Ally McBeal, but which it probably is not familiar to you. But I thought it'd be all kind of that. I mean, I thought I'd be Well, because I thought I'd be a barrister. Like I say, I thought I'd be swanning into court, putting on a show, winning a case, leaving and celebrating. And it was really naive because looking back, I did not realise, you know, the hard graft that goes on behind the scenes. You see all these dramas, like you say, on telly, and you think it's fat cat lawyers, you know, doing a couple of hours work and then leaving. The graft and the preparation and the amount of paperwork is, that was something that you have to learn along the way and not what you expected. But I mean, I think because I practice in family law, we try not to see it like wins and losses, because with families, it's not that straightforward. But there are those occasions where you still do get a win and you think, oh, yeah, this is the day. This is the legal career moment where you've done it. But it's a lot of, you know, nitty gritty repetition, doing the same tasks on different cases, but having to retain the information and the facts from that case. So, you know, the sheer amount of information I don't think I was prepared for at the time.
So, of course, yeah, it's there's definitely many complexities when you're actually practicing. But just leading up to it, I would like to just touch on the academic journey that you faced. Mm-hmm. You did mention that you wanted to become a barrister, and I understand you were accepted onto the bar course, but ultimately decided not to pursue it in the end. So it would be interesting if you could just share with our listeners why you decided not to pursue the traditional bar course despite being accepted, and what factors actually played a role in that decision.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think my parents were not happy when I shared that decision at all. And That was after university, when I'd gone traveling for a year, and I was in Bangkok standing in like this backpackers area. And I was like, I'm going to phone my parents and tell them I don't want to do it. And I think they thought come back. Yeah, I know. I think they thought I'd come back and, you know, just give up on working and travel the world, which I probably could have done. But I knew I had to go back to the real world at some point. I think in my last year of uni, I think it was probably the last year, I did 3 mini pupillages, which is sort of that week's work experience within chambers. And you should do that if you're going towards the bar course. And I really enjoyed it. And I did one at 4 paper buildings and got on really interesting cases in London. And then I did some training days for the bar courses as well. And I think there was a moment where I'd got out of education for the first time since I was 5 in this year traveling. And I just sort of thought, I'm not ready yet to do more education. And I want to get more practical skills and figure out whether this is actually right for me. Mm-hmm. I think all of the information I digested from those mini pupillages and training days, it just felt overwhelming and so serious. And I just think I wasn't quite ready for it yet. So I decided, I think I deferred the bar and decided to go and work for a year, but ultimately I didn't take it up and ended up getting a job when I came back home working as a legal secretary for a firm in Brighton and in family law, which I'd actually never studied. I didn't know anything about it. Knowing what I do now, I probably should have done it at university, but it was just one of the jobs that was available at the time that I got. So I worked for the partner there, and she had qualified as Silex and then cross-qualified as a solicitor. And because I got on with her really well, I think she just sort of encouraged development and learning. But, you know, I worked for a legal secretary for a good few years first.
How do you think your experience as a legal secretary shaped your legal career now? Were there any valuable like lessons you learned from those early days? Is there anything you can look back and say that, right, if I didn't take that break and become a legal secretary, the whole trajectory of my career could have been completely different?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's so important to have the fundamentals, even if, you know, I think later in your career, I'm fortunate enough where I get to delegate things to people now, right? So I don't have to do the admin stuff all the time. But you need to know how everything works from the ground up, and you need to know if ultimately that can hold your interest as you pursue the career in that way. The practical skills of a secretary and the organisation and just the hard graft of getting things done, which are not the most exciting of tasks, I knew, because I still wasn't bored by those, that actually this is something that I could keep doing for a long time and was an area that I was really interested in. You know, lawyers really benefit from fantastic support staff, and I wanted to be the best that I could be in that role. And I've always had that drive in each level I've gone through, which I think has helped me progress, I guess.
That's really good. So what advice would you give legal professionals who are starting off like a legal secretary and they have a similar drive to you and they want to progress on? What can they do to grow successfully within a law firm?
Yeah, I think, not to sound too harsh, but like graft, like put the graft in. Don't moan about the boring jobs, because there's a reason they need doing. Take that opportunity to figure out why they need doing. You know, we work with practice directions that tell you court bundles have to be done in certain ways. There is a reason for the things that you're doing. And if you want to absorb the law and learn, you can learn at whatever level you're at and have some initiative to go and find that out. You know, when I was a legal secretary, we were standing over photocopiers, we were hole punching. Now it's different because we're all paperless, and I know that a lot of other places are moving that way. We used to send the old snail mail and stuff, whereas now the pressure is even greater with emails coming in constantly. So I think, you know, if you work hard and can manage your time and things in the right firms, that will be recognised. And if it's not the right firm, then change it.
Brilliant. Love that. So just touching back onto the academic journey, just because I think it's very unique. It's not every day you hear someone, you know, being accepted onto the bar course and then changing, oh, I want to do Silex. So I just wanted to delve into it just a bit deeper. Were there any specific aspects of the Silex route that really caught your interest? Like, was it the style of learning, for example, because it was like maybe distance or online? Was it the actual modules inside? Was it the structure in general of just the qualification? What was it that made you? Because you could have possibly gone down at the time, probably the LPC route, for example, but you went on to Silex. So I'm just curious to know, was there any sort of specific things that drew your attention to Silex?
Yeah, I think for me, I knew I wanted those real world skills. And having spoken to my boss about it and how she did it, the opportunity to work, develop those skills and learn at the same time was much more appealing to me. Because, you know, if I went to the LPC full time, you only get to work at weekends. So you're probably not going to be doing any legal work. And that's what Silex gave me as a massive benefit over others, is I could study alongside my working. And, you know, they gave me a few days off for study leave when I did exams, but I did full distance learning. I didn't go into courses. I know some people, I think they go once a week or something like that. So really it was that. It was the opportunity to keep growing in a practice, but also qualify at the same time. And, you know, there's a financial implication of that too, that I didn't suddenly have to stop everything, take a year out, pay a load of money for a course, and could work at the same time. So it just sort of made sense to me. I just don't think I was ready to go back into full-time education right then.
You mentioned that it was, you know, probably a big shock to your parents finding out that you want to go an alternative route into law. Were there any other challenges in general that you faced? And if so, what sort of advice can you give to those who are aspiring to take an alternative pathway?
I think my parents were finally happy when I became a partner. I think they were like, oh, she's done it now. So I was doing Silex in 2007, I think, is when I started, or around then anyway. So early 2000s, mid 2000s. And there was a definite stigma about it at the time. It was a second class citizen. Solicitors didn't really know too much about the other routes to qualification. I was just fortunate that I was working for somebody who'd done it themselves. And I think that's because she'd done the GDL as well. So she'd sort of found a different route into law in the first place anyway, after a different degree. So I think that stigma is probably one of the biggest other challenges I had at the time. I don't have it now, fortunately. I know that it can still rear its head occasionally, but I think, you know, modern progressive law firms are far better. And there are now so many more routes into qualification that are properly recognised, that I don't think that challenge arises too much. I'd like to think it doesn't. But other than that, I don't, yeah, I think, you know, it made sense to people at the time while you're working and studying. So, yeah, I didn't have too many other challenges. Just managing your time, making sure you fit the study in really as well, knowing that you're going home at 5 o'clock and you're going to have to do 3 hours work or something.
So I haven't touched on the alternative pathways of law. So the legal profession has seen a shift with the introduction of a more accessible, flexible pathway, such as the solicitor's qualifying examination route. I'm curious to know, what are your views on the new SQE route?
Yeah, so it's still very new. So we haven't had any trainees yet who've qualified through that route, but we do have a couple doing it. So I can't sort of speak to how the outcome will be, really. It's not been around enough. I would say it fits more with Silex because, you know, Silex is a proven successful vocational route, and it gives you people qualifying who've had extended periods of time in a role, and SQE enables that. I know some firms are perhaps still offering seats, training seats for their SQE, but you actually don't have to do that anymore. So if you know what you want to do, you can stay within that for the entirety of the qualifying work period and really hone those skills and be supported. Whereas, you know, old school LPC period of recognised training, you could jump 6 months, and 6 months only scratches the surface in a practice area. So I think the SQE could make it better in that way. I also think it makes law more accessible, more open. It gives people the opportunity to be working, to not necessarily have a degree, as I understand it. So yeah, I think, you know, it also, from a business point of view, it kind of takes the pressure back off us. Whereas before, we had to sign off, you know, what everybody had done and how their training had worked. And it ultimately, the decision was ours if they became a solicitor, if we thought they were ready or not. Now we don't have to do that as much, as this is my understanding. I'm not the training lead at the firm, but so I think that's a positive. You're putting it back on the SRA and the Law Society to make sure you're really getting quality people through.
So I'm glad you touched on just the flexibility of course, now you don't need a training contract, and now you can just have such a variety of options to cater to the sort of study style that, you know, you're more prone to learn more and see yourself progressing more in. So, for example, you can take on online learning if that's the mode of study that best suits the needs that you have. So what do you think your potential benefits for actual employees? Because I know you've mentioned it takes back the pressure of you signing off on the final part of becoming a solicitor. Mm-hmm. But do you see any other benefits in terms of how it would be beneficial to the employees to do the SQE through like online learning, if they were working for your department, for example?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, we're all used to doing it now after COVID and everything as well. And I think you will know if you're the right person to do online learning and if you can commit to that. It's a bit like how I did distance learning when it had to be reading more. I didn't want to go and sit in a classroom. I didn't learn best that way all the time. And I think that can be a real benefit to an individual. I think as well, you know, having more time amongst peers, perhaps other trainees who are doing the learning. I know that we've promoted all of our trainees, no matter what route they're on, to get together, to share notes, to speak. And if there is online learning, that could be something that people do together as well. You know, I think you don't lose that sort of human contact just because it's online learning. It depends where you're working.
I agree. So just to touch on now what it's like being a partner, like, and working within family law. So mm-hmm. We've spoken with other legal professionals. So in one of our previous podcasts, we spoke with Her Honour Judge Sarah Davis. So she mentioned quite a few challenges that comes with working within family law. So it can often extend beyond the intricacies of the legal domain, often touching upon like the sensitivity and the sovereign nature of many family law cases. So that discussion, it really shedded a light on the multifaceted difficulties within the area of family law. I just wanted to get from your perspective, because obviously that's the perspective of a judge. So just from a partner, I don't know if it'll be any different at all, but what is it like working within family law? And particularly within your sector, are there any sort of challenges or equally rewards associated with this area of practice?
Yeah, so it's busy. Every trainee that we've had come into the department has been shocked at the pace of the work. And, you know, we do other practice areas like clinical negligence and private client and things which are perhaps slower, but, you know, certainly clinical negligence, still litigation. I think it is a bit of a culture shock when you come into this high paced environment. They'll be waiting for a court hearing for a year or two, whereas we've got 5-6 a week, you know. So I think the pace of it can be difficult. This is particularly with the care work that we do, multiple party cases, and the emails are relentless and constant. And so time management and being able to recognize and prioritize what needs doing right now and what can wait is really important. The benefits of the practice is that you get this insight into people's lives. They talk to you about things that they probably wouldn't even speak to their friends or family about sometimes. The flip side of that is that you can easily get drawn into it and you have to remember your role. And it can be fraught with emotion. Sometimes you're looking at the worst of scenarios, the worst situations perhaps that children have been in, and you see some pretty horrific things. And when you're involved with the family, you can carry that with you. So well-being is high on my list of priorities for everybody in my department, and having the opportunity to talk things over, making sure it's like sort of a supportive peer-to-peer relationship, is really important, because otherwise you'll burn out in this kind of practice area. So yeah, I mean, it is worth it though.
So you're not only, you know, practicing within family law, you're also someone like in a leadership position as well. So I'm just curious to know, what do you look for when you're hiring or promoting team members within your department?
So I suppose it's two separate things, really. With hiring, academics are important, and of course you have a look at those. But for me, I want to know who the person is and how they'll fit in my team. So cover letters are invaluable to me. I'm amazed how many CVs I get without cover letters. And, you know, they probably won't get very far, if I'm honest, because I want to get an impression of them. I want to know what life skills they have. I don't care whether, you know, you've been working in a supermarket. It's more about, what are your transferable skills? How are you with people? How will you fit into the team? So I suppose that when recruiting. In respect of promotion, I'm looking for someone to help me drive the business. It depends what level we're looking at, obviously, but, you know, having a commercial mindset is always helpful. And I don't think something you always learn when you're doing all the academics about how does legal practice actually work? What's the business model? But also quality of work, engagement with clients, and all of that feedback will lead to promotion ultimately. Someone who's just got a bit of hunger.
Really good. So I'm curious to know, how important is work experience and vocational training? Like, do you prioritize people with the academics, like who have flawless like grades, you know, in an LLB degree or Silex qualification? Or would you be more lenient or more towards rather somebody who has an extensive amount of experience but no qualification? Or is it equally just a happy medium? Like,
yeah, I suppose, like I say, when I'm looking at who the person is, the academics will then be read alongside that. But I don't really mind if you didn't get a first. I don't really mind if you know, I just want to see that you've been focused and you've worked to improve your skills, and whatever you've done will make you a valuable member. Because, you know, sometimes things go wrong. Academics is just a snapshot. Exams are just a snapshot. It's how the work experience sits alongside. I think I've had to change my attitude towards how I view legal work experience over the last couple of years, because nobody could do it during COVID. So all the sort of student, or, you know, the ones who are just coming out with a degree who've applied for jobs, they don't have that experience. So then, like I say, I'm looking at, right, what other jobs have you had? How will that work in practice? You know, what client contact have you had with people? One of the key ones I always ask is, how how have you ever diffused a volatile situation? Because we get that in family law, you know, and actually you could do that working in a bar, you could, you know, whatever, but it's those skills that sit alongside the academics. Yeah. And I suppose I don't mind if people have changed their mind either. If they've done a degree in something else and then changed their mind, I know how that feels. So, you know, I changed my mind too.
No, I really think it's good to hear, because we've conducted webinars before, you know, just speaking in general about obtaining work experience. And a common issue that a lot of people have mentioned is they don't have legal work experience. So they rule themselves out of the equation and feel like, I won't be a worthy candidate because I haven't worked in any law firm before. So it's good to hear that there are other transferable skills, and to really emphasize that if you've got that customer service sort of role, you can be seen as valuable in a law firm. You don't have to just say, I give up, I'm going to go back to my normal job because I don't think I'll win. So I'm glad you really touched on that, because I think it's a very important point. But if we could just touch on recruitment in terms of the SQE aspect. I know you mentioned you've got a couple of trainees. So how do you anticipate the SQE influencing your approach to recruiting new trainees for your team?
Yeah, so we're the kind of firm that does a lot of organic growth. So our paralegals who are interested in studying can approach the training team that we have and essentially apply internally. And that's where our SQE trainees have come from at the moment. I think it will allow much more internal recruitment and give people that opportunity, which is great for us as a business. We know that person, we know that they fit, and it gives someone, you know, we get years out of someone instead of a couple of years, and then they have to go somewhere else to do a training contract if we don't have one offered at the time. So I think, you know, that's the main benefit, really. I think potentially, and like I say, I don't know all the finer details, but I think there's some apprenticeship routes or talk about apprenticeship routes as well, which obviously would open that up more. So that could be really beneficial.
Really, really good. So people who've just looked at your career now in family law and they just desperately want to get started, what advice would you give them in getting started and how to progress?
Like I've touched on already, whatever you do, build your people skills. If you think you want to be in a client-facing practice area, and by that I mean the ones where you're dealing with individuals on a day-to-day basis rather than perhaps commercial or corporate, which may require different skills, build those people skills. Be able to adapt yourself so that you are relatable to a client from any walk of life. And like I say, I really believe you can do that in any job. You come across so many different people. Building relationships quickly is important in family law. Quite frequently, we're speaking to somebody the week before and taking them into court the week after. So you need to build those relationships so you can build the trust. I mean, of course, with family, the more experience you get, the better. Whether it's a law clinic, citizens advice, you go do some pro bono something or shadow a barrister, it is an emotional area, and you need to be confident that that's something you can do, because I think it does shock some people when we offer work experience weeks. We always sort of caution them about what they might see or what they might read, and if there's any problems, to come and talk to us. But I think for the right resilient people, it's a really beneficial and rewarding practice area.
Really good. So there are, of course, many aspiring legal professionals who face challenges while pursuing their careers. So not necessarily professional challenges, but more personal ones. It would be nice if you could share, like, maybe an example of a challenge that you overcame during your journey, just to, you know, inspire others out there who may be going through something similar.
Sure. I had a big old hiccup. So when I was in the legal secretary job that I was talking about, I decided to leave to progress to the next stage after I'd been there for a few years, and went to work for the Citizens Advice, who'd just got a legal aid contract at the time. I had been there for about 7 or 8 weeks when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. So I was 24 at the time, and obviously everything turns upside down. You don't know whether you're coming or going. And I had to sort of say to that job, you know, sorry, I can't carry on right now. And I took a period of sick before ultimately I left and I didn't go back. Thankfully, everything went well. But obviously, I went into a cycle of surgery and treatment, active treatment, and then less active treatment. So it took a long time, and I ultimately decided to take a year out of work. After that, I remember having this moment where I was like, that's it. I don't want to do a job where I have to deal with anybody else's problems. I've got my own problems. I'm not dealing with anybody else's. And I had a bit of a early midlife career crisis very early on, where I ended up being, I was a dog walker at one point, which was possibly the most stressful job I've ever done in my life. I volunteered at the RSPCA. I was in as a receptionist somewhere. But there came a moment when I thought, this is silly. Like, you've done all that work. You know you love it. I'd recoiled from it because of what had happened to me and what I was going through. And I didn't have the, I guess, emotional capacity at the time to deal with it. But I knew I wanted to go back into it. At the time I wanted to go back into it, there was nothing around that was completely family law. But I worked for somebody I knew as a legal secretary again. She did family and landlord and tenant, which is fine. I did that for a little while. I then did clinical negligence, sort of paralegaling, for a little while. But eventually, family kept calling me back. And I found my way into a paralegal role at another firm in town that sort of gave me the opportunity and also let me then finish Silex, because I deferred Silex because of my illness. And they were fine with that. They just, you know, needed a certificate or something, and went back into it and finished it off when I was there. So what I would say is, you know, I was 24, I was young, and I thought, I've got to get there now. I've got to have my career now. Actually, when stuff happens, there's nothing you can do about it. Yeah. Or even if it doesn't, there's no rush. You know, there's no, we have so many young people coming through who are like so keen to get to the next step. And I understand that the money is a motivator as well, but you can take that time, and you should take that time if you want it to, you know, have a year or do whatever. So, and that definitely gave me some perspective, I think, for keeping that work-life balance as well.
Yeah. It's really good. So I just generally want to know how you maintain a work-life balance. I mean, you're a partner, I'm sure you have a family as well, and being in a leadership position as well, it sounds like it could be a lot. So it would be good to just hear your advice on how to maintain a work-life balance and mental well-being while navigating the demands of the legal profession.
Sure, it is a lot. I get told off by one of my friends all the time that I don't say no to things. She's like, you just need to say no for once. I'm like, well, keeps me out of trouble. I suppose I make sure that I carve some time out for myself. So if we're talking about my own well-being, I have netball. So I play, I'm a training partner for one of the regional teams, and then I have my own little team. So a couple nights a week, you get an hour, you get on court with, you don't talk about work, you don't think about it, and you just get on with it. I honestly think sport and fitness, you know, I'm never going to be that person that goes to the gym at 5 o'clock every morning, but it's that thing where, you know, it gives me my time just to let loose. I got my other half's a lawyer as well, but he works in commercial property. So it's good because there's not too much crossover or shop chat. For me, yeah, taking the dogs out, spending time with my son, you know, trying to make sure you don't take it home with you. Obviously, you have to sometimes. I have to do some emails in my own time or whatever, but I manage my time so that if I want to pick my son up at 3:15, I can, and then I'll just work in the evening. So I think it's important for employers to be aware of that, you know, people have lives, and if you want to get the best out of people, you give them a bit of flexibility. You don't need to micromanage. You can trust them to be adults and get their job done. I think, as I touched on before, in family law, it can impact mental well-being. Vicarious trauma it seems like a relatively new concept. People are talking about it and doing training about it, but it has been around for years. Family lawyers burn out. That's what happens. So something I'm putting in place for my team is having either a supervisor or a coach that they can speak to, who's an external professional who works through their cases with them and tries to see what's getting under their skin about it, maybe if something like that's come up We also make sure that staff know that they can go to Law Care, which is a mental health and wellbeing charity, and just, you know, keeping the door open. If someone's been quiet for a few days, making sure you check in on them and make sure everything's all right. So, you know, and keep your eyes open. As management, that's what I try and make sure I do for the team.
Could you just share a piece of advice that served you well throughout your career that you'd like to pass on the next generation?
I think that you can take something from every situation. You can learn what not to do as well as what to do. So sometimes people get bogged down in, well, I wouldn't do it that way. Well, that's a really silly way of doing it. Great. Brilliant. Learn that. Take it with you in your career. The other thing that is key, I think, particularly for junior lawyers, particularly for people who are trying to prove themselves, is no mistake is too big that you can't overcome it, and never hide your mistakes. You know, we all make mistakes. We've all had that moment in our career where we've gone, oh God, what have I done? But it can all be solved. And, you know, people get themselves in real pickles when they don't just come out with it straight away or try and fix it themselves. So I suppose that would be a massive thing to remember right from the beginning.
Yeah, good advice. So in your opinion, what do you think are the key qualities to make a successful lawyer?
Empathy, being able to recognise professional boundaries, but also build relationships. I think being able to manage expectations, so the expectations that people put on themselves and their clients' expectations. It can be really easy to promise you'll do something by Friday and then think, oh, I haven't got the time to do that. That's fine. Touch base, let them know, you know, manage everybody's expectations. You've not put yourself under too much pressure, and they know that you're still thinking of them and you're coming back to them. I think junior lawyers and trainees can get bogged down in the detail and the minutiae because they're told to approach things and taught to approach them so forensically, which is great, brilliant. Love the attention to detail, but also to take that moment to stand back and look at the bigger picture and look at the case as a whole that you're working on and think, I have this task to complete, but actually, where am I going in the long term? Why am I doing this? And how does it all fit in? I think having the ability to stand back like that is a real key quality.
It's really good. So in the rapidly changing legal landscape, I mean, every day there's always something new that pops up and you have to learn. But how can young lawyers stay adaptable and continue learning throughout their careers?
I mean, there are so many webinars now. I think webinars are brilliant because you can fit them in wherever. You can be on the train watching them and, you know, keep learning stuff. So it's easily accessible sort of training in different modules. You know, a load of the barristers' chambers run them for free and they're brilliant. But also, I think the best way to learn is to listen. If you're in the office doing your role, but somebody else is on the phone giving advice, or you can hear people talking, absorb it. You learn far more about client care skills and how to manage situations listening to other people on that one side of the phone call. So I think, and that was something that was really, really impacted during COVID and made it really difficult for trainees. So I think that is probably the best way to just be a little sponge, basically.
As we conclude the interview, I'd like to ask, what is next for you? Is there anything in particular you'd like to share with us today? Any upcoming projects or developments that we should be on the lookout for?
Well, I have recently signed up to the Access Law Clinic, and will be me and my colleague, who's a matrimonial lawyer, will be offering some free legal advice sessions in that. From in respect of good law, our family department seems to be ever growing, and we're building up our presence in sort of Surrey and wider sort of South Coast. We've got legal aid contracts have come up for retendering and all that exciting stuff. So all of that's happening, because I haven't touched on it in this, but we do offer legal aid and private funding, because it's so important to me. I've got this overarching fairness principle, and to give people access to justice, we will always, for as long as I'm here, offer both. And I think personally, I've been doing a lot of talks to colleges and schools and to people, you know, studying law, and I'd love to do that more in the future. I think that's one of the things I really get a buzz from, it talking to young people who want to get into the law. So yeah, that's sort of what we're planning going forward.
Great stuff, thank you. And I'm glad you mentioned the Access Law Clinic. So just for the listeners who are not aware, Law Training Centre is in partnership with the Access Law Clinic, which is an online clinic that provides valuable pro bono work experience opportunities with practicing lawyers such as the amazing Emma Taylor and solicitors, by assisting those who would otherwise be unable to access legal advice. So at the same time, it will help you provide or achieve qualifying work experience for those who are considering the SQE pathways. If you would like more information or you have any questions about Access Law Clinic, please send an email to info@accesslaw.org.uk. But thank you so much for your time today, Emma. I really enjoyed this conversation. And thank you all for listening to the Legal Navigator podcast. If you have any questions or need any further information, you can also send us an email to info@ltckent.co.uk. Stay tuned for more episodes.